And a hearty arg welcome from Pirate Radio here in Santa Cruz, California. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, brought to you by, what is it? Brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial and by way of our online service at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Don't forget to tell all your friends and family to click on the red oval so you can hook up to the streaming link so you can hear the program. Mideast Migraines for this Monday, June 23rd, 2014. A hearty welcome to all our first-time and newer listeners. My name is Ren Tawil. If you insist, you can call me Lawrence. Larry will do in a pinch. I am your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American, bringing to you on this FCC-defiant, corporate, non-compliant to corporate desires underground pirate radio service, Free Radio Santa Cruz, liberating the airwaves since 1995. I know I read this to you either last Saturday or the previous Monday's program. It's not exactly spanking new news, but how many of you knew out there that legendary radio host and icon Casey Kasem was Lebanese-American? The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC, mourns the loss of Arab-American icon Casey Kasem. Dated June 15th, that would be a week ago yesterday. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, mourns the death of Casey Kasem, an Arab-American radio personality, actor, voice artist, comedian, and legend. Casey Kasem, born Kemal Amin Kasem, was a Lebanese-American best known for being the host of the show American Top 40 and for voicing Shaggy in the cartoon franchise Scooby-Doo. Yeah, I remember him. Not that I ever watched the show. At any rate, Casey Kasem was raised in Detroit, Michigan, to a Lebanese-American mother and a Lebanese father who worked as a grocer. Throughout his career, Kasem has been a strong supporter and advocate of Arab Americans and of ADC. He appeared at multiple conventions and lent his talent to defining and shaping the identity of Arab Americans. He always defended Arabs against efforts to demonize and dehumanize them. Kasem's career began young. After starting as a sports broadcaster in high school, Kasem landed acting jobs in radio dramas while at Detroit's Wayne State University, including The Lone Ranger and Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. He then served with the Armed Forces Network in Korea. He moved to Los Angeles in 1963, where he did small film roles and cartoon voiceovers, ultimately leading to a career in hosting Top 40 music programs. Kasem, Don Bustani, and Ron Jacobs founded the American Top 40 franchise in 1970, hosting it from 1970 to 1988 and from 98 to 2004. Kasem also hosted his own shows, including Casey's Top 40, Casey's Hot 20, and Casey's Countdown. In addition to his radio shows, Kasem provided the voice of many commercials and many shows, including Sesame Street and Transformers. He is survived by his daughters, Carrie and Jean Kasem, and Liberty Irene, and his son, Mike Kasem. He will always be remembered as a pillar of the Arab-American community and an embodiment of the great contribution Arab-Americans have made to mainstream popular culture in the United States. I believe he was either 72 or 82 when he passed. They do not specify here. Somewhere in that range. And no, I don't recall ever hearing his voice for more than a minute period of time doing anything on radio, television, or whatever. Even if I had known he was a Lebanese American, during the time he was most popular. Admittedly, that might not have made a big difference for me. But just so you know, now you know, Casey Kasem, or Kasem, which is more likely the proper ethnic pronunciation, was one of us, an Arab American. Again, you're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show, formerly the Mideast Madness Show, brought to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freak as in freak radio.org. Click on the red oval for the free link. By the way, these programs, when I can successfully record them, we've been having a bit of some technical difficulties lately doing that, but when I manage to record an entire program, I will move that recording to the archives for Mideast Migraines, which are located at another website, which is radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the number four, the digital character for A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. You may find the archives of almost all my shows there, including the readings of the book entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel by Max Blumenthal, which I read in its entirety over the course of 6 months on the Saturday time slot for Mideast Migraines, which comes to you every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Goliath having been finished and out of the way, we are now on They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby by former Illinois U.S. Congressman Paul Findlay. They Dare to Speak Out. Just starting chapter 5 now of that. That's this coming Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Okay, here's the phone number. I've got a sneaky feeling we're going to get some action on this today. Area code 831 4273772. Again, area 831-427-3772. That's the line directly to studio. I am here alone, so if necessary, kindly bear with me as I do the show and answer your call. You will not go immediately onto the air. I will answer it privately at first, and with your permission, we'll go on air. Call in at any point. Don't worry about interrupting anything. And also, you're welcome to call into the show just to check in, to let me know that you are, in fact, listening. Whatever your position on the subject matter is, things to do with Palestinians and Israelis and all that related stuff, it's nice to know if people are listening. No matter what your view about those things or what I have to say about them. I generally like to begin the show, having just begun it with the tribute to the late Casey Kasem, who passed about a week ago. I like to start by giving you some of the latest on the BDS movement, which is to say boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israeli academia or other cultural outlets, and that includes boycott of U.S. or other, perhaps multinational corporations who, in their business dealings with Israel, support their illegal occupation of Palestinian Arab territories. Okay, this is from Jewish Voice for Peace. Five things you need to know about Presbyterian divestment. And dated today, the Presbyterian Church is coming under an extreme attack for divesting from the illegal Israeli occupation. It's up to us to have their back. That's the title of this item from JVP. Dear Wren, I'm still breathless from last Friday's historic vote. The Presbyterian Church, USA, voted to divest from Hewlett-Packard, Motorola Solutions, and Caterpillar, all companies with well-documented ties to the Israeli occupation. This is the biggest move yet by any institution in the United States to take concrete, nonviolent action to end Israel's occupation. And now, a backlash unlike anything I have ever seen has begun. I can't emphasize enough how important it is that the Presbyterian Church hear from all of us now. And they want me to stand with these brave advocates for true peace and justice by signing their thank you letter. I'll get around with that sometime after the show. I know. We want to triple the 7,000 signatures on this card before our July 3rd deadline. And the link. And then she continued, she, Rebecca Vilcomerson, goes on to say, my jaw dropped when I heard Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu condemn the divestment vote on Meet the Press yesterday with the harshest words possible. Groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Jewish Council of Public Affairs came out with similar statements. At Jewish Voice for Peace, we have been inundated with hate messages. And then she puts in italics here. But these attacks are certainly coming down even harder on Presbyterians. In bold type, every member of the Presbyterian Church deserves our thanks for their thoughtful, heart-open, principled process. Okay, I want to skip here up to the entitled Five Things You Need to Know About Presbyterian Divestment. And with such an uproar over this decision, here are five things you need to know about what really happened. Number one, Presbyterian Church activists invited Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP, to partner with them almost a decade ago when they began to search for a way to reconcile their values and their investments. Through extensive study, corporate engagement, and broad interfaith outreach, they crafted a unique resolution that is grounded in their own values and worldview, a stirring model for how other communities can take action. Number two, you help make this happen. Whatever part of JVP's work that you participate in, whether for decades or days, you made this victory possible. Obviously, Rebecca here is talking it up here, trying to assure me that what I do with them and for them counts, and to garner more support for me, no question about that. She goes on to say, now the opposition's desperate talking point is that we are small and anti-Israel, but you know that is neither is remotely true. Our membership, our donor base, our campus chapters continue to grow because we all believe a true peace based on equality and democracy for both Israelis and Palestinians is worth fighting for. Number three, this process is an especially important model for Jewish communities and institutions. A recent study by the Jewish Council on Public Affairs, a harsh critic of divestment itself, shows that 25% of American rabbis, one out of four American rabbis, are afraid to speak their real views on Israel. The Jewish Council on Public Affairs says this, found out for themselves. The Presbyterian's process stands in stark contrast to the status of open debate within Jewish communities, where critical conversation about Israel has been systematically censored. Number four, this decision exposed an unspoken rule in the Jewish community. It's okay to oppose the occupation, but forbidden to pressure Israel to end it. Rabbi Rick Jacobs, chief rabbi of the Reform Movement, reiterated that cynical dictate last week, promising the church a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. And in parenthesis, parenthetically, she says here, never mind that the U.S. Secretary of State just spent a full year meeting with Netanyahu, only to see settlement expansion escalate. the question to always ask is, what concrete action to end the occupation are divestment opponents proposing? And number five, interfaith relationships don't only happen between Christians and Jews and don't only matter in the United States. Presbyterians invited not just American Jews, but Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim, into their deliberations. For all their talk about the impact of this decision on interfaith relationships, Jewish institutional leaders who criticized the vote aren't mentioning the impact on relationships with Palestinians of any faith. A silence that speaks volumes. I'll read that last point again. Number five, interfaith relationships don't only happen between Christians and Jews, and don't only matter in the U.S. Presbyterians invited not just American Jews, but Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim, into their deliberations. For all their talk about the impact of this decision on interfaith relationships, Jewish institutional leaders who criticized the vote are not mentioning the impact on relationships with Palestinians of any faith. A silence that speaks volumes. And this is just the beginning. In the days and weeks to come, I'm certain this resolution is going to lead to as yet unimagined opportunities and incredibly difficult challenges for all of us motivated not simply to talk, but to act for real justice. But first things first, please join me in saying thank you to our Presbyterian allies. Their work is an inspiration to us all. In Hope, Rebecca Vilcormerson, Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, headquartered in Oakland, California. Oh my God, that's so dangerously close to Berkeley and the whole ultra-liberal San Francisco human biome there, isn't it? You can go to jewishvoiceforpeace.org. I think you can also simply go to jvp.org or send an email to info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org to find out how you too can thank our Presbyterian allies. I suppose you can also go there to garner some information about who you can send your hate mail to. Yeah, I think that's striking that she talks about, where is it? Company's biggest move, Obama, Presbyterian. They've gotten a lot of hate mail from people who want everyone to believe that JVP and this divestment movement by the American Presbyterian Church is so insignificant because they're so small that they still have to make it a point to send hate mail to them, to barrage them with hate mail. Fascinating. 831-427-3772. You're listening to Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Let's do some news, a little bit of news roundup, which is brought to us by the American Task Force on Palestine for June 23. Oh, that's today. People are talking about the three Israeli teenagers who were kidnapped. President Abbas, that's Mahmoud Abbas, of the state of Palestine, formerly known as the Palestinian Authority, says there is no evidence that Hamas is responsible for the kidnapping of three Israeli teenagers. Oh, really? Let's see. Abbas says no evidence shows Hamas is behind kidnapping of three Israeli teens. Says no evidence shows that Hamas is responsible. This, by the way, comes from English.news.cn. CN means China in this context. English.news.cn. From Ramallah, Palestine, June 21, Xinhua Press. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said Saturday that there is no evidence that Islamic Hamas movement is behind the kidnapping of three Israelis in the West Bank. Abbas made the statement to reporters after meeting with members of the Arab Journalist Union that held a conference in both Ramallah and the West Bank and Gaza in solidarity with Jerusalem. He also told reporters that kidnapping three Israelis in the West Bank can happen at any place, quote, but it is not justified and not accepted, end quote, adding that the Palestinians are doing their best to bring the three Israelis back. And, okay. By the way, it's 3:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of North America. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, 3:30 p.m. Continuing with a news article. Three Israeli teenagers disappeared near the southern West Bank town of Hebron on June 12. Israel said they were kidnapped and accused the Hamas movement, of being involved in the kidnapping. The Israeli army therefore allegedly launched a large-scale military operation in the West Bank and arrested more than 400 Palestinians, including lawmakers, former prisoners, and leaders. According to Abbas, the Israeli army shot dead two Palestinian young men in the West Bank during a week-long military operation all over the West Bank to search for the three Israelis. No other details included in that paragraph. So the Israeli army shoots dead two Palestinian young men as part of the search for three Israeli young men. Like, that makes a whole lot of sense, okay? Let's go on here. Jerusalem, June 16, Xinhua. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke on the phone on Monday with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, asking him to assist finding the three allegedly kidnapped teens, according to a statement by the Prime Minister's office. Also, Jerusalem, Ramallah, June 19. Israeli security forces arrested 30 Palestinians in pre-dawn raids in the West Bank as they continued searching for three Jewish youths abducted in the area a week ago, the Israeli military said on Thursday. And let's put this aside for now. As I mentioned earlier, two Palestinians killed and 37 are arrested in raids by Israeli occupation forces in the West Bank. Let me take a look here. I think I have something. Something from one of my friends, good friends, about this whole business of presumably Palestinians kidnapping Israeli teenagers. Kindly forgive the dead air, but I think it's really important for me to find this. This is what I'm looking for. The other side of the story, the other edge of the knife, side of the coin here. There are countless, I mean really countless, instances of the IDF, Israeli so-called defense forces, arresting, grabbing, detaining youth from the very streets for alleged crimes ranging from throwing rocks at Israeli tanks or soldiers to just standing there, whether it goes against curfew or not. There have been a number of instances of Israeli soldiers breaking into houses in the dark of breaking into the homes of Palestinians in the dark of night and separating children from their families. These things do happen, and they are the details of these are there. If one really cares enough to get the details, and unfortunately, I've come across. I'm not pretending this, and I'm not hallucinating. I know I have some of these pieces, but I don't want to waste your time anymore. I failed to put them in their proper folder, so we're just going to have to let them go for now. Okay. Moving along. No, the Israeli army really does do that stuff, and they do it a lot. And half the time, at least half the time, they don't explain why they do it. I mean, talk about people, innocent people being kidnapped, either in broad daylight or in the dead of night. The IDF certainly has done its share. And I wouldn't be surprised if Israeli settlers illegal Israeli settlements have done the same thing to Palestinian Arabs. Okay. Back to the news roundup, June 23rd. A Turkish pathologist says a Palestinian detainee was beaten before dying in an Israeli jail. And that, my dear listener, is taken from Israel's premier, highest profile periodical, Haaretz, Tuesday, June 24. That's tomorrow, over there, right now. Well, please don't slow down on me now. I'm just waiting for this sucker to turn up here. Turkish pathologist says that a Palestinian detainee detained by the Israelis was beaten before dying in an Israeli jail from Haaretz by Jack Khoury. Yes, that's an Arab name. On June 23rd, a Palestinian who... Come on, please don't do that. Sub-explanation here. Expert claims Arafat Jaradat's injuries in early 2013 appear to have been inflicted with a long, thick object, contrary to Israeli experts' findings. A Palestinian who expired in Israeli detention was beaten before dying, a Turkish pathologist has claimed, in an expert opinion submitted to an Israeli court. Now that'll take too long for me to log in. I know that I'm in spurts and starts here, and I don't want to waste anyone's time. So instead of taking any more of your time on that, let's balance out the playing field here, and I'll read the next item, which interestingly enough says an Israeli teenager is killed in an explosion near the border with Syria. This is another piece from the Chinese news service Xinhua. Israeli youngster killed in blast on border with Syria. Jerusalem, June 22. An Israeli youngster was killed and three others were injured when a blast struck a vehicle on the Israeli-Syrian border on Sunday, prompting retaliatory fire into Syria, Israeli media and the military said. The army said a water tanker belonging to a civilian contractor outsourced by the defense ministry was attacked while carrying out maintenance work on the border security fence near Tel Hazeka in the central Golan Heights on the Israeli side of the border. And, of course, I'm presuming y'all know out there that the Golan Heights really belonged to Syria to begin with. That's worth mentioning to add to your context in appreciating this story. Continuing with this story, a 15-year-old boy was pronounced dead at the scene, the first Israeli to have been killed in the area in the three-year-old Syrian civil war raging across the border. Three others, among them his father, sustained light to serious injuries from shrapnel and were airlifted to a hospital in northern Israel. The cause of the blast was not immediately clear. Conflicting media reports attributed it to a stray mortar round, a rocket-propelled grenade, or an explosive device that was planted near the border fence. A military spokesman said a projectile tore a hole in the border fence, hitting the vehicle while it was delivering water to the contractor's laborers. Quote, "This was a deliberate attack, not errant fire," Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner told reporters in a conference call. I'm sure this would be a Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner in the Israeli army. He said Israeli tanks fired rounds across the border in response, engaging targets in the immediate vicinity that had likely included Syrian army positions. Large forces assisted by drones and helicopters were deployed to the area to search for gunmen who may have infiltrated into Israel. I suppose it's always a possibility. The Syrian civil war has spilled across the border on several occasions in recent years, with stray mortar shells fired by either rebel groups in Syria or Syrian government forces sporadically landing in Israeli territory and military patrols coming under fire, drawing return fire into Syria. Just making sure the ringers are on my telephone here. By the way, for what it's worth, 2 days ago when I was doing the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines on this very radio service, after I've closed up my show, my two-hour show at 1 p.m., I happened to notice the lights are flashing on my board here telling me that there was an incoming phone call on the line. There are two phone lines here, but I only give out the one. I don't want to confuse people. But on line number one, there was a call coming in. I panicked a bit because even though the show is over, I always want to answer the phone. I looked quickly at the buttons that I remembered turning back on when my show was done, because I do not take calls during the actual reading of the book that I was reading, They Dare to Speak Out, by Paul Finley, and carefully checked the button and saw that it was not completely, realized it was not completely flicked back to the on position because it made a clicking sound and I felt it. So that is my fault. And the light was still flashing, so I then picked up the handset and lo and behold, dial tone. So I wasn't running away from anyone. I didn't catch that particular call because of a very minor and frankly rather stupid technical problem. Or human error, I have to say human error. Terrible human error. Okay, returning to article. In one of the latest incidents last month, Israel fired artillery shells into Syria after a mortar round exploded near a military post on Mount Hermon, a strategic site Israel captured from Syria in 1967, but is still Syrian territory. Continuing, the army closed down the Quneitra border crossing on two occasions since the beginning of the year when battles between rebels and government forces inched dangerously close to the Israeli border. While in March, four Israeli troops were wounded when their patrol vehicle was hit by an explosive device. Lieutenant Colonel Lerner said Sunday's lethal attack on the civilian vehicle was unprecedented in severity as far as Israel was concerned. What the heck does that mean? Okay. So, we have a 15-year-old boy who was pronounced dead at the scene, an Israeli boy. And that's what that is. So I guess Israeli youth just can't catch any good luck these days. They are supposedly kidnapped. They are killed. How often does that happen to Palestinian Arabs? Does anyone honestly ask that question? Let's try this one. Israeli settlers open fire. It's the settlers now who open fire on Palestinians near Ramallah. Israeli settlers shoot at Palestinians near Ramallah. This is from the Ma'an News Agency. I believe that is expressly a Palestinian news agency. From Ramallah, which, by the way, is the de facto current capital of the state of Palestine, Ramallah. From Ma'an News, Israeli settlers open fire at Palestinians northwest of Ramallah late Sunday in the second such incident in hours, locals said. Two settlers shot at nine men who were working in a quarry near the village of Al-Mazra Al-Kharbiya without causing injuries, the workers told Ma'an. I guess they were just target shooting, eh? They said they noticed the settlers, Arab workers in the quarry, said they noticed the Jewish settlers sneaking into the quarry and fled the scene as settlers opened fire with an automatic rifle. After being chased for nearly 2 miles, the workers reached Al-Masra Al-Kharbiya unscathed, they told Ma'an. The Palestinians identified themselves as such and such and such and such a person, ranging in age from 10 years old to 32. Hard for me to know, but my guess is they were all male. An Israeli army spokeswoman did not immediately return calls seeking comment. Earlier, a Ma'an reporter said that Israeli settlers opened fire at Palestinians in Al-Bira near Ramallah, injuring one as mourners gathered for the funeral of Mohammed Tarifi. Tarifi was one of two Palestinians killed by Israeli forces early Sunday. No internet comments as yet on the story. Presbyterian Church in the United States votes to divest from some companies doing business in the occupied Palestinian territories. That's from The Guardian, as in the UK Guardian. The Israeli military conducts an airstrike near the border with or inside Syria. They're still doing that. Sunni extremists now control much of Iraq's western border. That would be close to Israel. This is in the Washington Post. Yeah, I'm just reading a headlines here because this is all part of the ATFP, American Task Force on Palestine's daily news roundup. But I want to get... There are two major pieces that I want to present to you today. It's 3:48 p.m. already. The time is flying. I think that means that I might be bogging down here on stuff that might be putting people to sleep. Which reminds me, how many of our listeners do we have right now? I have a magic box that says how many are listening online. And according to this... Okay, so maybe I've put a couple to sleep. or maybe you just didn't want to hear the things I was talking about. Don't forget, this show is being recorded, and if the recording pans out by the program's end, you can find it on this date, June 23rd, at the popular archiving website, radioforall.net, radioforall.net. Most of those recorded programs have duplicate filings with Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Santa Cruz Indie Bay. Indybay. All right. Now, here's something that's really important. I say it's important because I read the article last night in doing my show prep. And I think this is kind of some heady stuff here, because the author, Max Fisher, has done a lot of thinking about it and done a fair amount of research on it. This is called the end of, quote, both sides. Israel's occupation of the West Bank is indefensible. By Max Fisher on June 17. And I can't remember with whom this, with what news agency or periodical this may have been filed, so I'll just read it to you direct from the author. Jerusalem. This is a long piece now. Settle back and enjoy. In Jerusalem, Max Fisher, the author. There is a pleasant fiction in the United States and parts of Israel that the Israel-Palestine conflict exists in a sort of suspended animation, on pause and simply awaiting diplomatic resolution. But the truth is that the conflict, which over the decades has included several wars, countless terrorist attacks, and two Palestinian uprisings, never really goes away for most of the 12 million people in Israel and the Palestinian territories. And periodically it will escalate so rapidly, with such relatively slight provocation, and to such a level of severity that the rest of us can't ignore what every Palestinian and many Israelis already know, that the conflict may be quieter today than in the past, but it is still active, still destroying lives and communities, still scarring these two societies every day. One of these escalations is happening right now. On Friday, Israel discovered that three of its citizens, teenagers studying at a yeshiva in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank, had been kidnapped overnight. By whom is yet unknown. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insists it was the Palestinian group Hamas. He does like to harangue them, doesn't he? Continuing, Israeli intelligence officials say it was likely a few local Palestinians acting on their own. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insists it was the Palestinian group Hamas. Israeli intelligence officials say it was likely a few local Palestinians acting on their own. Hamas has denied responsibility. It's my experience and belief that if after this many days have passed, if Hamas has denied responsibility, it most likely is the truth, that they were not responsible. Continuing with Max Fisher's article, in a sense, it matters a great deal who did this. Hamas is both anti-Israel, is both an anti-Israel terrorist group and a political party that participates in official governance. So if it ordered this kidnapping, it could set back peace talks badly.
What peace talks?
But in another sense, it hardly matters at all, because this uncertainty has not prevented Israel from escalating the conflict aggressively. Here is a highlighted sentence in the middle of the article. Quote, this is an issue that looks less gray all the time. The occupation is wrong. It is the problem, and Israel is responsible. We'll probably come across that sentence again later in this article. Continuing with the article. In the 3 days since, the Israeli military has descended on the southern part of the West Bank, where the yeshiva students disappeared, and especially on the major Palestinian city of Hebron. I happened to visit Hebron. This is author Max Fisher talking. Fisher happened to visit Hebron the day before the kidnapping and found it already suffocated by occupation. Dozens of Palestinians have been arrested. Some estimates say 120, some nearer to 80. But all agree that it includes the entire population of middle-aged and older men who work for Hamas's political branch. Remember that they are also a political party. The Israeli military has severely restricted Palestinian movement in Hebron, forbidden residents under age 50 from leaving the country, and completely shut down all movement in or out of Gaza and the southern West Bank, save for, and I quote, humanitarian and medical assistance. Israel has presented this as necessary for its search for the kidnapped Israeli teenagers, and certainly it is true that finding kidnapped kids in a not-so-friendly city requires checkpoints and security forces. But to many Palestinians, the scale of the reaction and its severe impact on thousands of civilians looks an awful lot like collective punishment, the practice of punishing an entire population for the crimes of few individuals, which is barred by the Geneva Conventions that regulate international conflict. Many of the 100,000 Palestinians who commute to jobs in Israel have been prevented from crossing the border to get to work, much less see family on the other side of the line. And in Gaza, most gas stations have had to shut down for lack of fuel imports. The flavor of collective punishment has been reinforced by Netanyahu himself, who has repeatedly insisted that all of Hamas and even the more moderate Palestinian government led by Mahmoud Abbas are responsible for the three kidnapping victims. The 3 days of escalation are a response to the kidnappings, but in many ways are just the long, ongoing extension of the conflict and its inexorable eye-for-an-eye logic. When the Palestinians responsible for mass violence during the Second Intifada, or the Second Uprising, of the early 2000s did not succeed in achieving their aim of independence through violence, their answer was more violence. When the Israelis did not succeed in winning security and de facto security through occupation, their answer was more occupation. And superimposed over a full-color picture of an Israeli IDF soldier using a garbage dumpster for cover are the words, "It is not enough to condemn those who do wrong, but to understand the conflict that produces them." On with the article. You see the Israeli-Palestinian insistence on perpetuation in this week's crisis. Hamas's leaders may have told the truth when they said the group did not commit the kidnapping, but when they nonetheless celebrated the attack as a blow against the Israeli occupation, how could they not understand that such rhetoric does far more to enable the occupation than a kidnapping will do to end it? And while it would be wrong to blame the Israeli victims for their own kidnappings, one would still think that Israelis might want to question the role of Israel's occupation of the West Bank. As children, the kidnapped victims surely cannot and should not be held personally culpable, but they could be considered an extension of the occupation, which has been far from a peaceful endeavor. And what of the national Israeli policies that created the occupation, this most damaging aspect of the conflict, and then inserted three teenagers onto its front lines? There has always been, and there remains, plenty of culpability to go around in this conflict. Plenty of individuals and groups that squandered peace and perpetuated suffering many times over. Everyone is complicit, and no one is pure. No one is pure. The crisis over the kidnapped students shows all this. But it also highlights what has become perhaps the most essential truth of the Israel-Palestine conflict. For all the complexity of how it came to be and why it's continued, for all the shared responsibility for this week's crisis and everything that led up to it, the conflict predominantly matters for the human suffering it causes. And today, the vast majority of that suffering comes from Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. A reminder, I am reading from an article written and released on June 17th by Max Fisher. I wouldn't be surprised if Max Fisher is a contributing article to Haaretz, but I don't know, entitled "The End of, quote, Both Sides, end quote. Israel's occupation of the West Bank is indefensible." Okay, finding my spot here. Today, the suffering has become so disproportionately administered by the occupation and so disproportionately felt by Palestinians that, in a conflict famous for its complexity and its gray areas, this is an issue that looks less gray all the time. The occupation is wrong, it is the problem, and Israel is responsible. Israel's occupation has become so all-consuming that every incident seems to entrench the conflict and the occupation, and accomplish nothing else. Also on Thursday, in the hours before the Israeli teenagers were kidnapped, another conflict in miniature broke out. But while this one at first seemed like it might accomplish something and do it peacefully, both rare feats here, it dissolved quickly into the same old cycle. What happened is that Arab shopkeepers in Jerusalem, including the tourist-heavy Old City and its famous markets, shut down completely on Thursday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners who have been hunger-striking for weeks. Both strikes are meant to call attention to Israel's practice of administrative detention, by which it holds about 200 Palestinians without charge, Guantanamo-style, sometimes for years. The commercial strike was meant to nonviolently hurt Israel, which controls all of Jerusalem, and alert Israelis to what is being done in their name. The strike was widely noticed by Jewish Israelis, but no matter how many I spoke to, none had the slightest idea why it was happening. Some guessed it was a Muslim holiday, others shrugged. Nothing. On Friday, worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem's Old City, no doubt frustrated by Israeli apathy, organized a protest, which nearby Israeli security forces immediately and perhaps overzealously put down, injuring 28 and arresting 8. A protest. Injuring 28 and arresting 8. Israelis have largely given up trying to convince Palestinians to understand their point of view, that they crave security from their history of persecution. This is largely because the overwhelming force of the occupation means they don't have to convince Palestinians of anything, but Palestinians have few other options. What both Friday's nonviolent strike and Thursday's kidnapping have in common is a mission of breaking through Israeli apathy, of getting them to notice the occupation and care enough to want to end it. Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy generated anticipatable controversy when he wrote that, and I quote, "If in the West Bank yeshiva students aren't abducted, then the West Bank disappears from Israel's consciousness," end quote. To many, this sounded as if the column were encouraging Palestinians to abduct school-age Israelis. to others, presumably including the colonist himself, Mr. Levy, it may have rung true as a description of many Israelis' apathy to the suffering of West Bank Palestinians. I'd have made a slightly different point, that the violence of terrorism by Palestinians against Israelis is wrong and counterproductive, and that the violence of occupation by Israeli security forces against Palestinians is wrong and counterproductive, but that the conflict is engineered in such a way that violence is often the most or only viable way for either side to impress its will on the other. This neither forgives nor softens the wrongness of violence and those who do it, of course. But if you want to understand why the conflict persists in this way, it's not enough to condemn those who do wrong, but to understand the conflict that produces them. I'm going to just grab something to cool my achy throat with. That's a relief. Thank you for your patience. Continuing with Max Fisher's article. I've been to many strange places, but few have felt as unsettlingly creepy as the Israeli-occupied stretch of Hebron. This stretch of mostly empty buildings and dead silent streets, all motionless save the Israeli troops who shuffle between checkpoints to maintain total security in this miniature wasteland, is known as H2. H2 in the parlance of the U.S. brokered peace agreement that divided the city in 1997. This area, meant for Israelis and forbidden to non-resident Palestinians, is home to all of Hebron's Jews. The 1997 agreements grants them 20% of the city's land. They, the Jews, are 0.3% of its population. This is why the streets are empty. These people exist here only to occupy the land and to perpetuate Israeli control. The 500 or so Israelis who live here are considered settlers by everyone but themselves. If you speak to them, they will tell you this. Jews consider Hebron a holy city, so do Muslims, and began moving here during the Zionist movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries. In 1929, a mob of Hebron's native Arabs attacked the newcomers and killed about 65. Most of the survivors fled and were barred from returning when Jordan conquered the West Bank in the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. After Israel occupied the West Bank in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, some Jews moved to Hebron, either to reclaim property they believed was rightfully theirs by family inheritance or because they want to control the city as Jewish holy land. The Israeli military put the city under occupation, and in 1997, the Hebron Agreement divided it, which the Israelis here believe was to keep them safe from Arab terrorists. And we have a full-color, highly sunlit picture under the Palestinian-Israeli sun here of a Palestinian boy standing next to his family's water tank, which he said was destroyed by the settlers who built a home next door. Picture taken by the author, Max Fisher. Tank itself looks like it's in decent condition. So the inference here is that it is currently, at best, non-functioning. Continuing with the article, if you walk through the city's many Israeli military checkpoints, you will have no problem doing this as long as you are not Palestinian, although Israeli civilians are legally meant to be barred from crossing as well. You will arrive at H1, the 80% of the city that is Palestinian. This feels like a real city with noise and traffic and families crowding the markets. If you speak to people there, they won't tell you about 1929 or 1948 or even 1997. They'll tell you about today. Hebron is under Israeli military occupation, they'll say, and both the military and settlers bring daily torments and humiliations. Ask about today, and Palestinians in Hebron will tell you they can't cross over the Israeli-controlled section of their city and can't move freely in even the section that's supposed to be their own but is divided by Israeli checkpoints. They'll show you metal cages they installed over Hebron's long open-air market. The cages are covered in trash, and overlooking them are prim new buildings occupied by settlers, whom the locals say throw down their trash on the Palestinian market. They will look up warily at the Israeli soldiers watching from rooftops over their part of the city. They will tell you the names Nadim Nawara and Mohammed Salame, two local students ages 17 and 16, who were shot in the chest and killed by Israeli soldiers as they walked home from school 1 month ago. The soldiers were presumably on edge from a Palestinian protest earlier in the day, but security camera footage shows the killed students harmlessly walking down the street. Whether or not it was an accident, the deaths are a direct result of the occupation. Another highlighted quotation from the article here. For Palestinians in Hebron, and indeed in much of the West Bank and Gaza, it was just a larger dosage of the occupation they're force-fed every day. And there is a picture here of, to some, well-known advert-style signs, one in Hebrew and one in English, over a building, not terribly new looking, but not exactly ancient architecture either. I can read the English one. It says, "These buildings were constructed on land purchased by the Hebron Jewish community in 1807. I believe that's an O there, 1807. Sign says, "This land was stolen by Arabs following the murder of 67 Hebron Jews in 1929. We demand justice. Return our property to us." Signed, the Jewish community of Hebron. And that's the sign in the picture. The caption for the picture reads, "Pro-settler, anti-Arab signs put up by settlers in Israeli-occupied Hebron with watchtower in the background." Picture taken by Max Fisher. Continuing with this article, we're about three-quarters of the way through it now. It's not as heady as I first suggested. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? Okay, continuing. "If you walk to the edge of H1, you'll meet a Palestinian family that is unlucky enough to live not just under Israeli occupation, and not just in a city that bears notoriously deep scars from recent conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, but immediately adjacent to one of the settlers' homes. The two buildings are touching. Of the many differences between them, one is security. The settler home enjoys protection from the Israeli troops in the area, while the Palestinian home is defenseless. Another difference is water. The settler home, like most Israeli homes, has no water tank on its roof, likely because it is granted direct access to Israel's prolific water infrastructure. The Palestinian home gets its water from a tank on the roof, or it would had the tank not been punctured four times by what the family there says was an attack by the neighboring settlers. Israeli settlers here harass Palestinians because they want to take their land, because they are enabled by an Israeli occupation that gives them effective carte blanche to do as they please, and in some cases, out of a hateful belief that all Arabs are terrorists." I remind the listener, this article was written by someone who I'm quite sure is an Israeli Jew. I don't know if he is a freelance journalist, reporter, or what, but he is the author of this article. Again, he says, Israeli settlers here harass Palestinians because they want to take their land, because they are enabled by an Israeli occupation that gives them effective carte blanche to do as they please, and in some cases out of a hateful belief that all Arabs are terrorists. In 2003, during the Second Intifada, a report by the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem found that settler harassment in Hebron had driven at least 400 Palestinians from their homes, forced 2,000 Palestinian merchants out of work, and shut down three schools. Violence by Palestinians during the Intifada killed 11 settlers, including an infant. Things have improved since then, but a 2009 Red Cross report stated that settlers still regularly harass and intimidate Palestinians, particularly women, and will sometimes throw stones at children, Palestinian children, Arab children. The Israeli-controlled stretch of Hebron seeps with paranoid rage. The main street is lined with permanent hardboard signs urging everyone who stops by to remember and remain enraged by every incident of, quote, Arab violence, end quote, of the last 100 years. What a remarkable sentence. I'm going to begin this paragraph again. The Israeli-controlled stretch of Hebron seeps with paranoid rage, says this Israeli reporter here. The main street is lined with permanent hardboard signs urging everyone who stops by to remember and remain enraged by every incident of Arab violence of the last 100 years. Over a worn-down husk of a building that sits atop a former Roman slave market are two plastic signs, either of which appear more valuable than the building itself, declaring that this land was stolen by Arabs after Hebron's Jews fled in 1929. A settler woman ushers passersby into her home to recount the 1996 stabbing of her father, Rabbi Nissim Gudai. While she does not mention that settlers responded by storming the Palestinian market, attacking merchants, and chanting death to the Arabs, her repeated insistence that, quote, Arabs are terrorists, makes it clear that she does not see peace as viable or worth pursuing. One of H1's principal monuments is the grave of Baruch Goldstein, an American-born Israeli who shot and killed 29 Palestinians in Hebron in 1994, making him a hero of the far-right Israeli extremists who are well represented here. Most Israelis loathe Goldstein as a terrorist himself, and the Israeli government bulldozed the shrine next to his grave in 1999. But most Israelis don't live out in Hebron. They live in a world away in Tel Aviv or Haifa, sunny coastal cities with booming tech sectors and liberal values, far from the daily wounds and humiliations of the occupation carried out in their names. Palestinians in Hebron only know of Israel, the military occupation, and the settlers who are its vanguards. On Saturday, when the Israeli military sent hundreds of troops into Hebron to shut down checkpoints and to search house to house for the kidnapped yeshiva students, for most Israelis, this was national news, so important, many followed it hour by hour. For Palestinians in Hebron, and indeed in much of the West Bank and Gaza, it was just a larger dosage of the occupation they're force-fed every day. Of the many tragedies of the Israel-Palestine conflict, one of the greatest may be that it does not just disproportionately harm civilians, many conflicts are this way, but that it seeks at every turn to pull regular people across the invisible line from civilian to active combatant. I'm going to read that again. Of the many tragedies of the Israel-Palestine conflict, one of the greatest may be that it does not just disproportionately harm civilians. Many conflicts are this way, but that it seeks at every turn to pull regular people across the invisible line from civilian to active combatant. The kidnapped yeshiva students were treated not as harmless students, nor even quite as settlers, which, as unarmed vanguards of the occupation, exist in their own gray area between civilian and soldiers, but as analogous to enemy combatants, fair game in the fight. And the Israeli government has responded by arresting dozens of Hamas political leaders, deciding that it would be better to push them into the category of terrorists, of criminals responsible for an act they may have had nothing to do with, than allow them to continue existing in a gray area. It's a conflict that feeds on endless escalation, on upgrading every civilian to a passive combatant. Israeli families are accused of abetting the occupation, Palestinian families of abetting terrorism, and every passive combatant to a frontline fighter. It's a dynamic that serves nothing and nobody but the conflict itself. But while it's accurate to say that, in quotations here, both sides participate in this awful cycle, that both sides indulge their worst habits in ways that perpetuate the conflict, there is an essential truth that is not about both sides. It is utterly disproportionate. Only the Palestinians are under military occupation. While the conflict hurts everyone here, any one Palestinian is far more likely to be hurt than any one Israeli, and is apt to be hurt more deeply. Another quotation here from elsewhere in the article. The Israelis want to enforce the status quo because they see the status quo as succeeding for them, while Palestinians want to blow it up, end quote. Continuing with article. This leads to other kinds of asymmetry in the conflict. While there are certainly exceptions to this, individual incidents of violence are often touched off by a Palestinian attack. Israelis may tell you this is because Palestinian extremist groups such as Hamas have embraced terrorism as a strategy, and this is true, but there's a structural cause as well. The Israelis want to enforce the status quo because they see the status quo as succeeding for them, the Israelis, while Palestinians want to blow it up. They want to blow up the status quo. This makes the Palestinians the frequent instigator, as with Thursday's kidnapping, but Israelis' disproportionately greater power and their willingness to use it makes them the cause of on net greater suffering and more numerous abuses. This is not a point about who is more or less morally righteous, but an observation on the structure of the conflict and how it shapes Israeli and Palestinian political behavior in such a way that hurts both and serves neither. But it hurts Palestinians much more and serves them even less. We're almost done here, folks. In fact, this is the very last paragraph. Of course, as American colonists and American diplomats frequently say, the occupation is a potentially moral threat to Israel as well. If it continues long enough, then as the Palestinian population grows to outnumber Jews, Israel will lose its claim to democracy, to a Jewish national identity, or both. But that's not the argument that should matter. The argument that should matter is that the occupation is now the primary driver of the Israel-Palestine conflict. It is illegal under international law, and it is a cause of tremendous humoring suffering. And for what? If you like a copy of this article, all I can tell you is, date June 14th of this year, author is Max Fisher, M-A-X, Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R, and the full title of this article is The End of, quote, Both Sides, Israel's Occupation of the West Bank is Indefensible. June 17th. You know, I have come across actually a great number of literary work on this topic, mostly in the form of articles, far shorter than full books or small booklets or pamphlets. But the message still appears to be the same. This is only the latest one that I've come across that I felt would be worth reading to you. It's 4:24 in the afternoon, Pacific Daylight Time. Let's have a short musical break. Once again, the phone number is area code 831-427-3772.
Hey, hey, hey. كنت في الغرض وكنت اللاهد في اللازرينة تيويتي أغلهم كنت في الغرض وكنت اللاهد في اللازرينة
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 on the FM dial and streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the link. Just taking care of some technical items here. Now I'm drastically looking for the piece that I wanted to read to you, which is not nearly so apparent as I was hoping it would be. It's not in here at all, is it? Isn't this awful, people? Well, that is a bummer. That'll have to wait until another time. However, and it's 4:33 p.m., by the way, Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of California. This just came down the chute. Again, from the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, a U.S. American, a United States organization, primarily, about a half hour ago, while I was reading the other stuff to you, this from the ADC. The ADC condemns Israel's deadly raids in the West Bank. Again, this has to do with the three Israeli teenagers apparently abducted. Washington, D.C., ADC.org, June 23. Remember, we're talking about essentially, chronologically, three missing Israeli youth. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee strongly condemns the recent raids by Israeli security forces throughout the occupied West Bank, the killing of innocent Palestinian civilians, and detention of hundreds of Palestinians, including children and prisoners released in the Gilad Shalit deal, without trial. Israel continues to systematically violate Palestinians' universal human rights and illegally occupy Palestinian land under the auspices of Israeli security. In response to the recent alleged kidnappings of three Israeli boys, Israel has engaged in collective punishment and disproportionately devastated the civilian Palestinian population. Over 1,000 sites have been searched by the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, have kept the city of Hebron on complete lockdown for 10 days. Today, Mondovice reported that, and I quote, over 350 Palestinians have been arrested in the West Bank, and five Palestinians have been shot dead. Again, we're talking about what was started by the ostensible kidnappings of three Israeli youth. 350 Palestinians have been arrested, and five Palestinians have been shot dead. Continuing with this communique, while ADC unequivocally condemns the kidnapping or mistreatment of any human life, Israel has demonstrated a consistent pattern of valuing the lives and rights of Israeli settlers at the expense of Palestinians. ADC adopted the #BringBackOurBoys campaign in order to highlight this moral discrepancy. ADC supports the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement as a nonviolent way to compel the end of Israel's continuous human rights violations and illegal occupation of Palestinian territory. Through these nonviolent movements, activists are seeking to create international pressure on Israel to abide by international law and end the occupation of Palestine. And when they say Palestine here, when ADC talks about the occupation of Palestine, they refer to those territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and in effect, the Gaza Strip, which, according to international law, is still considered to be occupied by foreign forces because of the economic siege laid upon it by Israel. The term occupation of Palestine here does not refer to the state of Israel recognized as legitimate and secure by the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Palestinian Authority. Continuing with communique, last week the United Methodist Church decided to sell over $100,000 of stock in G4S, the world's largest private security company that profits from Israeli prisons. The Methodist Church said that the decision to divest was made, quote, due in part to concerns about the company's involvement in human rights violations in the Israeli prison system, and the military occupation of Palestinian territories, end quote. Bill Gates also recently sold his entire stake in G4S, and the security company itself has pledged to end Israeli prison contracts over the next 5 years. On Friday, the Presbyterian Church USA voted 310 to 303 to divest from companies that aid the Israeli occupation. The church held about $21 million in Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions. These companies profit from the illegal Israeli occupation by selling bulldozers, surveillance technology, and equipment used at checkpoints that all contribute to the oppression of the Palestinian people. Many Jewish activists with Jewish Voice for Peace attended the convention to show support for human rights and divestment from Israel at a time when the Israeli Likud government has been employing the tactic of divide and conquer by passing a law to label Palestinian Christians as non-Arab. This solidarity amongst progressive Christian and Jewish organizations sends a strong statement that we are all on the same page. I'll read that again because I did not know this, and I want to flesh it out here a little bit. At a time in the Israeli Likud government, Likud is the one of two ruling parties in Jerusalem, at a time when the Israeli Likud government has been employing the tactic of divide and conquer by passing a law to label Palestinian Christians as non-Arab, this solidarity amongst progressive Christian and Jewish organizations sends a strong statement that we are all on the same page. The rapidly culminating momentum behind divestment from Israel demonstrates that the Palestinian question is not a racial or religious issue, but a fundamentally moral issue and matter of universal human rights. ADC congratulates the Presbyterian Church and all BDS allies for standing on the right side of history. Take action now. Stand on the right side of history and pressure Israel to cease its illegal and immoral treatment of Palestinians. Urge members of Congress to support BDS and stand against Israel's infringement of universal human rights and international law. Contact your congressional representatives now. And, of course, ADC is making that easy for me with its email computer link here. Otherwise, you may go to ADC.org, I guess, yeah. Well, the informational email address is ADC@ADC.org. Otherwise, go to ADC.org, its website, or antidiscriminationcommittee.org. I don't know why they don't make those links, or at least the labels, more visible here. I guess they're stupid, huh? I guess they're just plain stupid. I guess they just don't care. What do you think? You can still call me at area code 831-427-3772. I know you're out there. And it is 4:42 p.m. this Monday, June 23rd, so you know that if that's the situation is the same for you, that the show is live and you don't have to worry about ringing someone else's program and bothering them. 831-427-3772. Just let me know you're out there, folks. Give us a sign, will ya? Yeah. That's a good one there. That was a good communique. I'm so embarrassed, folks.
Reading from a couple of weeks ago. Shame on me. What a drag, man. What a frickin' drag.
I do have in my hot little hand here a mailing from the JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace. I think you may have read from this before. Let's take a look at it again. Oh, this is the Jewish Voice for Peace annual report for 2013. Minute 7 seconds. JVP activists take action online or in the streets an average of once every 1 minute and 7 seconds. Here's a timeline going back to May of 2012. Go and Learn kicked out of 14th Street Y. Young Jewish and Proud dialogue about BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, was banned from the 14th Street Y hours before the event begins. Organizers continue events in local city park, May of 2012. Ooh, something about 60 Minutes. The remarkable reports of the Israeli army's antics in occupied territory. Thank you, 60 Minutes. April 2012. JVP counters Israeli censorship campaign and generates 36,000 letters supporting 60 Minutes program that accurately reported on Palestinian Christians in the Holy Land. Again, that was back in April of 2012. JVP counters Israeli censorship campaign. Yeah, you know, that's so typical of what happens when you try to get the truth out on this topic, on these kinds of topics, through the American mainstream media. Anti-Semitism baiters and the pro-Israeli camp goes crazy when the American public is exposed to what's really going on over there. TIAA CREF drops Caterpillar from their social choice fund. Ooh. Pamela Geller, Islamophobic ads. JVP chapters in four cities work in multi-faith coalitions to fight Islamophobic ad campaigns. September 2012. Sheldon Adelson attack. JVP runs ads in Jewish newspapers nationwide challenging Sheldon Adelson-funded smear campaign against JVP rabbis. September of 2012. Interesting things like that. Let's get some quotations from members and supporters of JVP. Steve Feldman, medical doctor in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. After growing up deep in the Jewish community of Washington, D.C., I gradually came to the realization that my understanding of Palestinian people was terribly misguided. My understanding of Israel was profoundly affected by learning that Israel was created by the expulsions of whole villages of peaceful Palestinian families. I'm an enthusiastic supporter of JVP, the one Jewish organization I see that walks the talk of Jewish values. Paul Cavell, Oakland, California. The Palestinian liberation struggle is necessary, powerful, and growing. JVP's work to end the occupation is creative, strategic, and effective. With one check, I get to support both. Let me see. I still appear to be recording here. That's nice. And, that's encouraging. People are listening to this program, folks. Danny Kaplan, Chicago, Illinois. At last, I found an organization that matches my values. Pursuing a rights-based approach to peace. I am inspired by JVP's strong leadership in the exciting new directions this organization is going in. Dara Wells Hajar, New York, New York. Jewish Voice for Peace inspires me because our organization stems from a place of love and justice with a commitment to human rights. JVP has created a beautiful community of dedicated activists, teachers, mothers, fathers, grandparents, students, and artists from all over the world. We're working together in solidarity with Palestinians and Israelis towards ending the occupation of Palestine and bringing justice to the Middle East. Ed and Ethel Swede, San Diego. At the 2013 National Member Meeting, we are very impressed by JVP's leadership and membership and rock-solid commitment to equal rights and all people. We returned home and not only began to launch a San Diego chapter, but created a legacy fund which will provide future annual funding for JVP in perpetuity. Karen Platt, Albany, California. I believe that it's crucial for American Jews opposed to the occupation and the human rights violations committed by the Israeli government to take a strong public stand. I'm inspired by JVP's contributions to this growing movement for justice for the Palestinian people and also towards minimizing the anti-Semitism that I believe results from Israel's unconscionable actions and policies. So here, this individual, Ms. Platt, recognizes that anti-Semitism may be caused from Israel's misdeeds and wrongful policies. She's not saying that all anti-Semitism stems from that, but that Israel's actions and policies themselves can actually feed into anti-Semitism. I think that's very important. Couple here of biographical type quotations. Welcome new board members, Karen Ackerman, former political director, AFL-CIO. JVP plays a unique and absolutely critical role in the progressive movement in our country today. JVP speaks to the imperative need for true equality, human rights, and economic rights for Palestinians as the only true path to peace. Committed to building a national grassroots movement through its chapters and in alliance with partners in organizing national campaigns, JVP is key to changing the dialogue in this country. Finally, James Seamus, professor of School of the Arts, Columbia University, former chief executive officer of Focus Features, and producer of Brokeback Mountain and screenwriter for The Ice Storm. I think of JVP as a normalization project. It's actually normal to practice real Jewish values and actually abnormal to blindly support things like occupation and oppression. Well, this is why I've hung on to this mailing here from a while back. Some eyebrow and heart-raising quotations from members and supporters. See the piece of paper that I was frantically searching for the last half hour or so was one that I began reading 2 or 3 weeks ago. It has to do with, it's entitled something like The Enormous Price That Americans Pay for Israel. So, it's a title to that effect. The Enormous Cost of Israel to the American Citizen. It's put out by the website called If Americans Knew, which is an excellent website if you want facts, documented and documentable facts concerning things that you can see, that you can count, and events that are well documented, well observed and witnessed, that you can refer to, If Americans Knew. Yes, this is Allison Weir's website, pretty much. Just remember that phrase, If Americans Knew. Google that. Now, we're going to put this program to bed. And see what I can do about properly filing and archiving the recording of this program. Seems to have turned out well, according to the numbers here. I'll be back with you again next Monday, of course, at 1500 hours. That's 3 p.m., 3 in the afternoon, next Monday, as every Monday, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Locally heard at 101.3 FM. Radio, and of course the stream is live on our online service at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the proper, for the link that you need in order to hear it. And if you're hearing me now either on the radio or on a friend's computer and you've had difficulty in the past picking up the stream, remember that the link will only bring you the proper coordinates to the audio program itself, but in order to hear it, your computer equipment, your internet connection has to have the proper audio program, like Real Player or Real Player Cloud. Maybe iTunes does this. Windows Media Live, I think it's called. Stuff like, you know, a program like that, you can do it. Maybe your computer already has that link, or you've set it up previously, but if you don't, you need an audio program such as those to make the link work. That's how it goes. It's not terribly difficult for most people to figure out. So if you want to listen to us on your device other than a radio with the old-fashioned dial knob thingy, click the red oval and employ your audio stream program device thingy. Okay. Thanks again for listening. Of course, there is the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, where I continue my reading currently in Chapter 5 of They Dare to Speak Out. Thanks again.